This is Taking Aim with
Rav Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, January 17th, 2006. It's called The Program. It's the largest domestic spying operation since the 1960s, larger than anything conducted by the FBI and CIA inside the United States since the Vietnam War. The program is a program of domestic data mining of telecommunication that is so vast and so unprecedented that it makes a mockery of long-standing privacy rules. James Risen, in his recent book, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, entitled State of War, reveals that the Bush administration has swept aside nearly 30 years of rules and regulations and has brought the National Security Agency back into the business of domestic espionage. President Bush secretly authorized the NSA to monitor and eavesdrop on large volumes of telephone calls, email messages, and other internet traffic inside the United States without search warrants or any new laws that would permit such domestic intelligence collection. Under a secret presidential order signed in early 2002, only months after the September 11th attacks, President Bush gave the NSA the ability to conduct surveillance on communications inside the United States. James Risen and Eric Lichbau revealed this before the publication of Risen's book State of War in a series of articles in the New York Times on December 15th. What also came out is that the New York Times hid this information for over 1 year, and that President Bush intervened to try to stop the publication by the New York Times. Today on Taking Aim, part two of Stripping Away the Democratic Facade. Last week, our program, The March Toward Dictatorship, discussed a Pentagon program, the Department of Defense, and its broad net over data mining with its CIFA programming. Today, part two, Nowhere to Hide, examines the National Security Agency. Ralph.
The Risen book, and by the way, we should make clear that the New York Times sat on this prior to the election in 2004. A revelation which would have had considerable impact, since when we examine exactly what is at work here, we see that there is no longer any pretense they are going to sweep away any formal constitutional protections, any facade of democratic entitlement, any notion of due process, any entitlement to a presumption of innocence, any freedom from nonstop, overwhelming, totalitarian spying. But this documentation that the New York Times had prior to the election, they sat on for something like 14 months. And the only reason why they published it just recently is because their reporter was going to publish a book and scoop the New York Times 14 months after the fact. Quote, "The Bush administration, as you say, swept aside 30 years of rules and regulations, eavesdropping on people across the United States, phone calls and emails in the millions without court-approved search order." And the magnitude of this is such scale that, as Risen writes, the NSA is tapping into the heart of the nation's telephone network, direct access to key telecommunications switches that carry all of America's daily phone calls and email messages. And the magnitude of this is such that no one is immune, everyone is covered. The largest spying operation ever to be undertaken in the United States, and it is an exponential increase in the march towards totalitarian control.
Ralph, we call this the largest spying operation since the 1960s, because in 1978, Congress instituted FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Security Act in 1978, and that was in response to the large-scale spying against people, U.S. citizens, in the 1960s. James Ridgway, in an important article in the Village Voice, December 30th of 2005, the article entitled "The Bush Family Coup," noted what happened between 1960 and 1974. He said the FBI conducted 500,000 investigations of so-called subversives without a single conviction and maintained files on well over a million Americans. The FBI tapped phones, opened mail, planted bugs, and burglarized homes and offices. At least 26,000 individuals were at one point cataloged on an FBI list of persons to be rounded up in the event of a national emergency. Hoover was particularly obsessed with Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, and he thought was influenced by communists. The FBI proceeded to undermine the civil rights movement, planting agents among the Freedom Riders, and also, Ridgway notes, the Ku Klux Klan. Hoover put spies into the ranks of labor activists and of the Democratic Party insurgents during the 1964 presidential campaign. It's also been revealed that organizations such as the Socialist Workers Party were well infiltrated at that time. Meanwhile, the CIA began spying domestically. The agency planted informants of its own within the United States, especially on college campuses. Between 1953 and 1973, the 20-year period, they opened and photographed nearly 250,000 first-class letters, producing an index of nearly 1.5 million names. Under something called Operation Chaos, separate files were created on approximately 7,200 Americans and over 100 domestic groups. In 1964, the CIA even created a secret arm called the Domestic Operations Division, the very name of which flew in the face of its legal charter. Back then, there were no, quote, communications problems between the two agencies. Now, this was all documented by the Church Committee, that is, in the committee that was established by Senator Frank Church, the U.S. Senate Select Committee to study governmental operations with respect to intelligence activities. And in 1976, they issued a report, and a result of that was the development of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, enacted in 1978. Now, this brings us up to the NSA spying, because to overturn the system established by FISA in 1978, which was the secret court where the government would go to get warrants to spy on people, and there's maybe one or two warrants that have ever been denied about of the tens of thousands of warrants that have been issued, this brings the NSA back into domestic wiretaps without court approvals. And to do so, administration lawyers issued a series of secret legal opinions, similar to those written in support of the interrogation tactics, the torture that has been used on detainees captured in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Ralph has done some important research about these legal opinions and the basis for them. Ralph?
Yes, Maya, before I deal with John Yoo, and the legal authorization for the legal pretext for these operations, let me make the following observation. You made reference to the fact that in the 60s, J. Edgar Hoover deployed these monitoring and controlling and surveillance operations to target Martin Luther King. What's essential is, I mean, we did a special yesterday on WBAI with Alambe Brath, as I did for WYTF in Gary, Indiana, regarding the assassination of Martin Luther King. That surveillance by J. Edgar Hoover under this vast spying program on Americans that unfolded during the 60s and during the time of the war in Vietnam targeted Martin Luther King with a very specific purpose in mind, because the assassination of Martin Luther King was entirely dependent upon that moment-to-moment surveillance of his every move. And J. Edgar Hoover was having his operatives meet The 111th Military Intelligence Unit was assigned the assassination task. The 20th Army Command was assigned that task. The coordination by military intelligence of the assassination of Martin Luther King would be documented in the trial in Memphis that was in which lawyer Bill Pepper prosecuted one of the conspirators with the assistance of Dexter and Martin Luther King III. I mention this because it is completely relevant and germane to the purpose of this surveillance, the purpose of this totalitarian control. This is not academic interest in what we're communicating with each other. This is to prepare for the martial law state. This is to facilitate the detention and disappearance of people on a scale never before imagined. And indeed, when we look at the book State of War by James Risen, when he describes this surveillance process, he links it to the covert operation authorizing, quote, the Central Intelligence Agency to kill and capture people around the world. And indeed, the book makes reference to the fact that the head of the CIA, George Tenet, never demanded written presidential authorization for the techniques of torture that were to be deployed. Now, the reason that that was not sought is made very clear by James Risen. Bush was purposefully not formally briefed, and written presidential authorization for these disappearances of people and their torture and detention was based upon a, quote, secret agreement among the most very senior administration officials to give Bush deniability even as his vice president, secretary of defense, and senior lieutenants were meeting to organize the harsh new interrogation methods. Indeed, in order to avoid a requirement for, quote, presidential finding, the CIA determined that these interrogation tactics, namely torture, should be considered a part of the agency's normal intelligence collection rather than to be defined as covert action. And this entire process through which the people who are targeted are disappeared and subjected to torture was the heart and soul of the expansion of the spy capacity. The NSA operation is tied inexorably to the methods of disappearance. The legal opinions, as you indicate, Meyer, supporting the operation, both the the NSA operation followed, again, secret deliberations over expanding the NSA's role. Days after September 11th, 2001, John Yoo, a Justice Department lawyer in the legal Office of Legal Counsel, prepared an internal memorandum to demonstrate that the government could deploy electronic surveillance techniques and equipment far more powerful and sophisticated than those ever undertaken before, and in those available to law enforcement agencies to monitor all communications.
To intercept.
And to intercept, you're quite right. And to control the movement of persons wherever they are in the United States.
Without warrants, Ralph.
Hugh stated, these actions will raise constitutional issues, and the government will have to undertake them without reference to their impact on individual liberties. Now, the full meaning of this was nowhere better demonstrated than recently in Chicago. Let me mention to the in regard to this that John Hugh is a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. He was the law clerk to a right-wing justice, and he was given access to the White House and was allowed sufficient authority to determine what role the NSA could have in monitoring communications of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil without a warrant. In Chicago on the 1st of December of last year, there was a debate between John Yoo and Professor of Law Douglas Cassell from Notre Dame. At a particular moment, John Yoo was questioned in the following fashion by Douglas Cassell. Cassell, if the president determines that he has to torture people, and in particularly including the crushing of the testicles of a person's child, and what Douglas Cassell outlined was that a man or woman is detained. They want to coerce that person into talking to them. They bring the 10-year-old child of the victim in his presence and, quote, crush the testicles of the person's child. Is there any law to stop him? Hugh, no treaty. Cassell, no law by Congress? Is that what you're writing in the August 2002 memo? Hugh, it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that, quote unquote. No better index, brothers and sisters, of the measure of degeneration and the criminalization of this capitalist state. Conceivable, is it, that the top legal official that is authorizing interrogation techniques and surveillance and torture for the Bush administration in public forum declares that it is entirely why the president finds it necessary to crush the testicles of a child in the presence of his parent as a method of interrogation? The Daily Cardinal, the newspaper of the University of Wisconsin in Madison. It is the only newspaper, by the way, that has taken up this issue. Another index of the degeneration and the rapidity with which the society is degenerating. You would have expected in the bourgeois press a crocodile tears outcry with the resignation of Hugh demanded, with the denial of the president expected. No. As the Cardinal, Daily Cardinal indicates, it is John Yoo who helped write the Patriot Act, the Justice Department memos to the White House that expand the powers of the executive, that organizes the military campaign that is targeting the American citizens, that makes torture the central modality. According to you, to John Yoo, the executive branch must have total flexibility, and that the president has the authority to do anything he chooses. That there is no law, there is no institution, there is no congressional mandate that can inhibit, restrain, or encumber the entitlement of the president to crush the testicles of a 10-year-old child in the presence of his parent.
Or to spy without any oversight. And as we know, there is spying and surveillance anyway, but this is stripping away the so-called democratic facade where there is no counterbalance to what is going on. And it was revealed that it's not just against so-called terrorists or dissidents in the United States. This spying goes on against members of Congress themselves, and that's why Congress is particularly anxious about this new overt power that the president is granting to himself. It was revealed at one point by somebody who used to work for the National Security Agency that spying went on against Senator Strom Thurmond, among others. Now, what Ralph is referring to with John Yoo is a broad interpretation of Article 2 of the Constitution, which grants power to the president as commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Relying largely upon constitutional powers, Congress passed a resolution just days after September 11th attacks, granting the president the authority to wage a global war on terrorism. Senator Daschle, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time, says that there is no way that this resolution was granting overarching power to the president and eliminating the checks and balances provided by Congress and the judiciary. But the Bush administration lawyers, such as John Yoo, are saying that there's a broad interpretation of Article 2, and once Congress passed that resolution, the president as commander-in-chief has total power. What has been called by some the presidential dictatorship, or as the New York Times now refers to, with President Bush and Dick Cheney, the imperial presidency. Now, the Bush administration lawyers decided that the war resolution also provided the legal basis they needed to support the National Security Agency operation to eavesdrop on American citizens. Previously, this operation, which is Echelon, is the big computer program, and we're going to discuss that in great detail, that this Echelon operation could be used against foreigners and their broad satellites around the world in order to eavesdrop on foreign communication. But here he decided that they could also eavesdrop without any warrant, that is, without any notification upon U.S. citizens. Now, the Bush administration has never publicly discussed the NSA operation. That is, until the revelations by the New York Times on December 15th on its internet site and December 16th in the publication itself. The Justice Department has hinted at the administration's thinking on domestic spying, notes James Risen in a little-noticed legal brief in an unrelated court case in 2002 that he discovered. The brief said, quote, "The Constitution vests in the President inherent authority to conduct warrantless intelligence surveillance, electronic or otherwise, of foreign powers or their agents, and Congress cannot, by statute, extinguish that constitutional authority," end quote. The search for foreign agents has led the NSA to peer into the domestic streams of data. Ralph.
One of the things that becomes very clear from James Risen's book and from accounts in the New York Times is that these preparations for the virtual arrangement for martial law proceedings in the United States and for the effective transformation of the presidency into a dictatorship preceded the events of 9/11. They were already on the drawing board, and John Yoo was being consulted and indeed was preparing for the rationalization for these measures prior to the pretext that made them feasible. December 23, 2005, an article in the New York Times on this, "Junior Aide Had Big Role in Terror Policy," by Tim Golden. Moments after the planes crashed into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, lawyers in the Justice Department's elite Office of Legal Counsel began crowding into the office of one of the agency's newest deputies, John C. Yoo, to watch the horror unfold on his television set. Look carefully at what is being told us here. Moments after the planes crashed, all of the lawyers were crowding into the office of a new deputy, John C. Yoo, to watch these events unfold. We all stood around, watching the events. He seemed very calm. He was wholly calm, as if he had already anticipated what was unfolding. Within weeks, Yoo began to establish himself as the critical player in the Bush administration's, quote, "legal response to the terrorist threat," and a decisive and influential advocate for the expansion of presidential authority. While a mere deputy attorney general in the legal counsel office, Mr. Yoo was the primary author of a series of opinions, including one that declared that the Geneva Conventions do not apply, and two others that countenance the use of, quote, "highly coercive interrogation techniques." He then wrote a still secret memorandum that gave legal backing to the administration's secret program to eavesdrop on the international communications of Americans and others across the United States without federal warrant. All of this apparatus that was implemented after the pretext of 9/11 was in advance prepared by not only John Yoo, but he was the point man. When the attack on the World Trade Center occurred, all of the lawyers are going into the office of this mere deputy assistant attorney general to watch the attack and the...
Excuse me, Ralph, not attorney general. It's the Office of Legal Counsel for the President.
A mere deputy assistant attorney general in the legal counsel office is the way he's described, Maya, in the article here in the New York Times. And indeed, the point I'm making here, which I think our listeners will well understand, is that 9/11, the attack on the World Trade Center, is a pretext, is a prearranged undertaking, is the rationale for the unleashing of the totalitarian state, for the escalation of imperial invasion and the multiple wars that are on the agenda with the PNOC and with World War IV, as James Woolsey and his neocon colleagues outlined it. Mr. Yu was with a very specific background, with Clarence Thomas, the Chief Justice, with from the chambers of Judge Silberman, and was the point man, as I indicate, for dismantling any facade of democratic entitlement, of legal process within the United States, and needing and preparing for all this in advance of 9/11, and then very, very consciously and with great deliberation deploying the events of 9/11 to bring about the forced march to a totalitarian state.
Ralph, we'll discuss later the ACLU's analysis of these laws and how they are illegal, that these presidential directives are illegal. But also the Congressional Research Service, which is an independent research arm of Congress, it's part of the Library of Congress, issued its analysis, and this was reported by Eric Lichtbau and Scott Shane in the New York Times on January 6th. Report questions legal basis for Bush's spying program. They don't agree with John Yoo. What Eric Lichtbau writes, President Bush's rationale for authorizing eavesdropping on American citizens without warrants rests on questionable legal ground and, quote, may represent an exercise of presidential power at its lowest ebb, end quote, according to the Congressional Research Service. The legal rationale, they state, does not seem to be as well-grounded as the Bush administration lawyers have suggested. And there will be more about this in the coming months, particularly as the ACLU has done an important analysis. Aside from the legal issues, let us look at what this eavesdropping entails. There are 9 trillion emails sent in the United States each year, according to industry experts. Americans make nearly a billion cell phone calls and well over a billion landline calls. That's 2 billion telephone calls each day. That's almost 750 billion telephone calls each year. These are swept up by the National Security Agency and with a recognition not only of voice but of key words. The sweep captures the messages. This is telephone calls, faxes, emails, and with another program, internet sites. Following President Bush's order, the U.S. intelligence officials secretly arranged with top officials of major telecommunications companies to gain access to the large telecommunications switches that carry the bulk of America's phone calls. They not only carry the bulk of America's phone calls, it's been revealed that the United States has arranged that much of the international switching mechanisms also pass through the United States, so that if you're calling from Europe to Asia, your call is probably going through a switch in the United States, which makes it available for the National Security Agency to capture within the United States. The NSA gained access to the vast majority of American email traffic that flows through U.S. telecommunication systems. None of the press have yet been able to reveal which of the major telecommunications companies this involves, but we can imagine it is all, especially since there has been the recent industry consolidation in telecommunications. This is reminiscent of what went on with the airlines, with the data mining that was involved in sweeping through the airline, the purchase of airline tickets, and it was later revealed that most of the major airlines had given over passenger information to the U.S. government to test its data mining program. And here we have the U.S. corporate executives of the major telecommunications companies also secretly making arrangements with the government for our telecommunications information. And it's not just the telecommunications company, it involves the large computer and software and hardware manufacturers. Ralph?
Maya, with respect to the rationalization and the legal authorization that John, you prepared, that allows the NSA to construct surveillance on the emails of virtually any American and to escalate this on a scale that has never before been seen. When the NSA finds potentially useful intelligence, it is entitled to deploy this on every single person who lives in the United States. But what I want to emphasize here is that the targeting of communications of people across the United States and the control of their movements through monitoring of their communications is in the State of War book by James Risen linked directly to the torture that is also authorized. Who authorized putting Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on medication? Maya, you want a break for station ID?
Yes.
But before we do, I want to make a very important announcement, brothers and sisters. Please, Ethical Cultural Society on January 24th at 7 p.m., Joan Mellon, in her seminal presentation of the CIA's role in the murder of John F. Kennedy, in a presentation based upon her extraordinary book, A Farewell to Justice, she will be at the Ethical Cultural Society on January 24th at 7 p.m., at 66th Street, 2 West 66th Street. Be sure to make it January 24th, 7 p.m.
We will break for a brief station identification.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. This is Reverend Jesse Jackson. Please call and support WBAI, Non-Commercial Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Stripping Away the Democratic Facade, Nowhere to Hide. Ralph?
Who authorized putting Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on medication? John Yu. Who authorized the subjection of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to mind-altering drugs, to putting him through the extremis of drowning? Who authorized the prevalence of torture? Indeed, as James Risen documents, the entire program of extraordinary rendition, kidnapping people and disappearing them in secret bases around the world, it flows from the same authorizations to allow the president to do anything he chooses without reference to the Constitution, law, legal entitlement, or congressional approval. The CIA would have its own prison system. The CIA would be allowed to create a system to make people disappear, I'm quoting. CIA prisons were secretly established under this authorization. Two major ones, codenamed Bright Light and Salt Pit. Salt Pit in Afghanistan. And then there is Bright Light, a secret location still not identified. Quote, the word is that once you get sent to Bright Light, you never come back. The CIA interrogation techniques that are authorized under these memoranda. Torture. If you read the interrogation reports, you see that what is being done is systematic torture. It is the accumulation of all the procedures. And what is involved here is the application of torture to anyone at any time at the discretion of the president and under the authorization provided by these legal memoranda. And as we've seen, that entails as well the crushing of testicles. One of the points that is made here by James Risen is that the actual architecture of this legal entitlement that is being manufactured for the president makes it a wholly unnecessary exercise to bother with a Patriot Act. It is, in fact, an exercise in deception. It is a smoke and mirrors operation. Because even while the Patriot Act is being submitted in Congress and all the fanfare attached to it and the debates that are going on with respect to it, what James Risen reports is that the operations that the Patriot Act itself does not dare to include have been implemented behind the scenes. So what is being disclosed here is that everything that goes on in the way of congressional legislation, submitting legislation, debate over legislation, is a facade, is a feint, is a fake operation to occupy people with what can be done and what cannot be done while they are doing it anyway on a scale that their legislation doesn't present, propose, or contemplate.
Ralph, you had mentioned before that the preparations for the NSA spying powers began prior to September 11th. A January 3rd report in the online magazine Slate discusses the NSA's attempts to gain access to telecommunications switches before 9/11. A former telecom executive told Slate that the efforts to obtain the calls dates back to early 2001, predating the 9/11 attacks and the president's secret executive order. The Slate reporter Shane Harris and Tim Naftali wrote, quote, "The source, who asked not to be identified so as not to out his former company, reports that the NSA approached U.S. carriers and asked for their cooperation in a data mining operation, which might eventually cull millions of individual calls and emails. A report written by the NSA in December 2000 for the incoming Bush administration argued that the agency had to develop new ways to exploit modern communication systems. While circumspect on the specific programs, the Transition 2001 report, made public after a Freedom of Information Act request by the organization National Security Archives, called for the expansive monitoring of telecommunications. An earlier report, June 1999, by Lieutenant General Jim Clapper of the NSA Scientific Advisory Board, argued for similar measures." This is the National Security Archives has obtained a copy of this report, but it's heavily redacted. But what we can see from the parts that are revealed by the government is the development of, quote, "a digital network intelligence," and this is defined as the intelligence from intercepted data communications transmitted between or resident on network computers. "Modern communications pose the problem of, quote, manipulating huge volumes of heterogeneous, complex data." And, in fact, the NSA goes through 2 million pieces of communication per hour. The fact that this is happening is not new. The Palestinian attorney Abdin Jabara exposed that his faxes were being monitored by the NSA many years ago. But what we have here is outright presidential authorization and the Bush administration claiming it as a right that it can intercept large swaths of data mining, that is, the telecommunications of broad groups of people, in fact, anyone and everyone, and do it with full license.
Well, Maya, James Risen makes the point very clearly The NSA banks of supercomputers at Fort Meade are the home of the greatest concentration of computing power in the world. The Patriot Act gave no new powers to the National Security Agency. The Bush administration, I'm quoting, did not seek congressional approval for the NSA operation because the White House recognized it would be too controversial and would be rejected. It is now clear that the White House went through the motions of public debate, a fake debate over the Patriot Act, all the while knowing that the intelligence agencies were secretly conducting a far more aggressive domestic surveillance campaign. And there is the real gravamen of what we are witnessing here, the scrapping of the facade, and indeed the hidden state forward steps forward by Jonathan Schell in The Nation. Spells this out, as does the ACLU's document, NSA Spying on Americans, because what is being explicitly stated now by bourgeois liberals, I should say, by the way, this is the same arena of a political commentator that has excoriated those of us who have tried to expose the totalitarian nature of the capitalist state, and in particular the meaning of 9/11 as the pretext for sweeping aside any bourgeois facade, the necessity of 9/11 for permanent war and for permanent subjugation of our people. The government authorization of 9/11 is on a par with their authorization of torture, with their authorization of the hidden state, as Jonathan Schell chooses to call it in the January 9th, 2006 issue of The Nation.
I recommend our listeners go to the ACLU website and look at the NSA Spying on Americans is Illegal, their December 29, 2005 report. They go through the court cases and constitutional decisions to show that the surveillance is illegal. Period.
But
is
my
conclusion.
Yes, with both the ACLU and Jonathan Schell in The Nation and James Risen in the New York Times and James Ridgway in the Village Voice are arriving at the conclusions that we were and many of us who are engaged in this work have been putting forward for a number of years. The hidden state steps forward. While the New York Times revealed that George Bush had ordered the National Security Agency to wiretap the telephone communications of American citizens without permission, the justifications offered were derisory, as Jonathan Schell states. One argument is derisory, the other deeply alarming. The derisory argument is that Congress, by authorizing Bush to use force after September 11th, had authorized him to suspend any legal impediment, such as FISA, although that law is unmentioned in the resolution. And then the alarming argument states, the author of this article, Jonathan Schell, is that the commander-in-chief has inherent authority to suspend laws. He can suspend FISA at his whim and in secret. What need is there, then, for to pass or not pass the Patriot Act if any or all of its provisions can be secretly exceeded by the president, Jonathan Schell asks. And that dovetails with what James Risen is stating, that these debates are fake debates, that secret law-breaking, as Schell describes it, is supplanted by brazen law-breaking, and the difference is critical. If abuses of power are kept secret, there's the possibility that when exposed, they will be stopped. But if, when exposed, they are celebrated and embraced, then every remedy has failed and the abuse is permanently ratified. What is being ratified is that this presidency is above any law. There is a name for a system of government that wages aggressive war against its people, deceives its citizens, violates their rights, abuses power, breaks the law, rejects judicial and legislative control of itself, claims power without limits, tortures prisoners, acts in secrets. It is dictatorship. It is dictatorship, states Jonathan Schell in The Nation. It is tyranny, states the ACLU in the NSA Spying on Americans. It is the total abrogation of any pretense of democratic process in the United States, declaims the American Civil Liberty's Union. Brothers and sisters, it is the totalitarian state that is being openly and explicitly proclaimed here. And when that is conjoined with the entitlement not merely to surveil us, but to detain us without due process, and to interrogate us in such fashion as John Yoo openly embraces on December 1st in his debate in Chicago with the professor of law from Notre Dame, crushing the testicles of a 10-year-old child to extract information from the parent, that is the signature of the fascist state.
And Ralph, critics are considered to be aiding and abetting the enemy. This was established in President Bush's radio address of December 17th, following upon the publication in the New York Times revealing the existence of his directive to have blanket warrantless eavesdropping wiretaps. President Bush came out and said that to fight the war on terror, I am using authority vested in me by Congress, including the Joint Authorization for Use of Military Force, which passed overwhelmingly in the first week after September 11th. I'm also using constitutional authority vested in me as Commander-in-Chief. In the weeks following the terrorist attacks on our nation, I authorized the National Security Agency, consistent with U.S. law and the Constitution, to intercept the international communications of people with known links to al-Qaeda and related terrorist organizations. He says this is a highly classified program that is crucial to our national security. And what he goes on to say, and what Dick Cheney and other administration officials have gone on to say, is that if you do not support what they are doing, you are aiding and abetting the terrorists themselves. I think that we should go into some of the mechanisms of the echelon program, that is, how the broad sweep of wiretapping, the listening in on telecommunications of U.S. citizens and people internationally is done.
Yes, Maya. In fact, that's the critical culmination of what we've been describing today. Here is the piece, as you indicate, by Jason Leopold on January 9, 2006, in Truthout, the NSA spy engine echelon. A clandestine National Security Agency spy program codenamed Echelon is responsible for tapping into the emails, telephone calls, and facsimiles of average American citizens over the past years. The existence of this program has been known for some time. Echelon was developed in the 1970s. The spyware operated by satellite is the means by which the NSA eavesdrops on Americans. A top-secret program codenamed Tempest.
A parallel program was
operated by satellite and is capable of reading computer motions, cash registers, and automatic teller machines from a half mile away. It is used to keep a close eye on American citizens. Echelon has been shrouded in secrecy for years. A special report prepared by the European Parliament in the 1990s disclosed explosive details about the covert program. Indeed, Echelon is not only used to spy on American citizens, but it is used to spy on foreign defense contractors, the European companies Airbus and Industry and Thomson, the CSF, were spied upon in order to direct the contracts to American corporations.
Ralph, so here we have two programs. Echelon, which provides a sweep of telecommunications, and we have also the telecommunications company and the computer companies working to provide trap doors and back doors. These are terms that we've used before to have access to our telephone calls, our emails, our faxes, and this is cell phone plus landline calls. And then we have this parallel program called Tempest, which is also operated by these satellites that sweep around the world, that is capable of reading computer monitors, cash registers, and automatic teller machines, all of these things linked up through the telephone lines and via the Internet.
Maya, under Echelon, the NSA, throws, quote, an extremely wide net over all electronic communications worldwide, and in specific reference to target Americans in every location in the United States. Quote, there are no warrants. There are no probable cause requirements. There is no FISA court. Any information is intercepted, and that is the information communicated solely between U.S. citizens within the United States, writes Jason Leopold. And on March 2nd, 2000, 60 Minutes did a specific segment on Echelon, worldwide conversations received by the Echelon system. If you made a phone call today or sent an email to a friend, what you said and what you wrote was captured and screened by the country's largest intelligence agency, the top-secret global surveillance network called Echelon, run by the National Security Agency and four English-speaking allies, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. And the 60 Minutes report states that and describes how the all information that is gathered is captured and is deployed for the purpose not only of monitoring people, but for preparing for their control. What most people don't realize is that virtually every signal radiated across the electromagnetic spectrum is being collected. We can't see them, but the air around us is filled with invisible electronic signals. Everything from cell phone conversations to fax transmissions to our ATM transfers. Every square inch of the world is covered, says Mike Frost, the former spy who is being questioned by Croft of 60 Minutes.
Mike Frost, Ralph, was a spy for CSE, the Canadian equivalent of the National Security Agency. And in that 60 Minutes program, he gave a very ominous example of how innocent and routine conversations that we have between our friends and our family can end up in the NSA on the NSA watch list.
Well,
this was the conversation.
They end up on the watch list, all right. The question then is what action is taken in relation to them.
He said, while I was at CSE, this is a classic example. A lady had been to a school play the night before, and a son was in that play, and she thought he did a lousy job. Next morning, she was talking on the telephone to her friend, and she said to her friend something like this, "Oh, Danny really bombed last night." The computer spit that conversation out. It contained the word bomb. The analyst who was looking at it was not too sure what the conversation, what the woman was referring to. So, erring on the side of caution, he listed that lady and her phone number in a database as a possible terrorist.
But, Maya, look. The National Security Agency, here is Croft describing what, in fact, we are dealing with here. Because, yes, I mean, puns on bomb and that. Anybody is monitored because everybody is being designated for control. And what emerges here is the following. Quote, the echelon control by the National Security Agency helped identify the two Libyans who blew up Pan Am Flight 103. But brothers and sisters, the two Libyans had nothing to do with the bombing of Pan Am 103. The Central Intelligence Agency bombed Pan Am 103. That's something we've documented, the Lockerbie bombing and the exposure in Barron's publication and the Toronto Star and by the intelligence private group Interforce CIA. That was a false flag operation. So NSA is not just deployed for controlling our every movement and for monitoring our every communication and preparing us for detention under the same kind of treatment that is being accorded people designated as aides to terrorists across the world. But the operations themselves that are terror operations are being conducted by the United States authorities, as in the case of Pan Am 103, And then the echelon totalitarian control of our communications is deployed to frame us, to frame people for the events authored by those who are in control of the National Security Agency, the ruling class of the capitalist state. Even members of Congress are targeted. And the NSA refuses to provide internal memoranda even to Portagos, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee and now the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, was denied access to this the scale of this operation at the time. Indeed, 1,000 pages of such monitoring were carried out over the late Princess Diana. What is it, very interesting about this, because Princess Diana was targeted because of her campaign against landmines, although there is more to that than the landmines issue, and the monitoring of her every movement and the control of the information pertaining to her figures in the death and the murder, which is what it was, of Princess Diana, another subject, another aspect, another expression of the meaning of the totalitarian state. Popular Mechanics, Spying on Us, January 1st, 2001, The Secret is Out. Two powerful intelligence-gathering tools are being used to monitor Americans across the United States. Echelon, a detailed documentation of the deployment of Echelon here in in Popular Mechanics as a device for not just monitoring what we say, but preparing for the control of our movements. There is a 90% chance that NSA is listening when you pick up the phone to place or answer a call overseas. We are in the presence, brothers and sisters, of the legitimization and the crystallization of the totalitarian state. There is nowhere to hide. There is no way to pretend. There is no longer any basis for having illusions about the empty meaning of the bourgeois facade. We are in the presence of a plan for the total control of our lives, and if there were any doubt about the necessity for committing ourselves to fundamental change, revolutionary change, a challenge for power in the United States, the march towards the totalitarian state, which we are documenting here and which we will continue to describe, should answer that question for all of us. Brothers and sisters, again, let me remind you of the Ethical Cultural Society, 7 p.m. next Tuesday, January 24th, 2 West 64th Street, a farewell to justice. And we will be with you next week to continue with our description of the advent of the martial law and totalitarian state in America.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Stripping Away the Democratic Facade, will be up on our website, www.takingaim.info, and on the WBAI archive, www.wbai.org. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. This has been a two-part program, Stripping Away the Facade, Part 1, The March Toward Dictatorship, Analyze the Counterintelligence Field Activity and Its Data Mining Operation, Part 2, Nowhere to Hide, Examine the Eavesdropping of the National Security Agency and Stripping Away any Democratic Protections by Presidential Decree.
Symbolized, brothers and sisters, by John Yoo, and the crushing of the testicles of 10-year-old children as the signature of the martial law state. Thank you.